This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Hey everyone, this is John from The Cinephiles. Look, we talk about mental health more openly now. Certainly I do on my shows, and Steve and I have certainly talked about it a number of times here on The Cinephiles. But asking for help can still feel hard. And BetterHelp's latest research confirms it. BetterHelp's 2026 State of Stigma report surveyed 2,000 Americans and revealed that 85% of Americans believe getting support is wise, yet 74% say society discourages people from doing so. That's a gap that we really need to address in the coming years. I know for me, it was very important to reach out, and I was very lucky to have friends who were supporting me to get that help and reach out to a therapist and find my way back to myself for sure. So it's an important gap that we need to address. And certainly BetterHelp is here to encourage people to get therapy and to get help through them. They have over 30,000 therapists. BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session, based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the United States, and BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. Don't let stigma stand in the way of support. Start therapy with BetterHelp. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. My first feeling when I think about the fact that it's almost summer is excitement. The kid's going to be out of school. We got vacation plans, family plans, projects around the house. But then I start to think about it and I realize my kid's going to be out of school. I've got travel arrangements to figure out, family visits to schedule, and those projects around the house aren't going to do themselves. Plus, my work doesn't stop when the days get longer. In other words, when I think about the summer, anticipation can morph pretty quickly into just plain stress. I absolutely want to have a great summer with incredible experiences for my family, but my stress isn't going to help. So if I want to be the best dad I can be, I need to take care of myself, and sometimes that means I need a little help. BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews, they do the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. You don't have to be on this journey alone. Find support and have someone with you in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com. That's betterhelp.com.
Hatch, if you go, we've all got to go with you. Hatch. We can't go back without the goalie.
Hatch, if we run now, we lose more than a game. Please, Hatch.
Hello and welcome to the very first edition of Cinephiles One Takes, where we might explore the themes, the history, the filmmaking, and some of the influences it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Rocha. I'm a writer, producer, host, and voiceover artist in San Diego, California, and excited to be jumping into a new venture with you here, Steve, as a offshoot, spin-off of The Cinephiles.
That's exactly right. We want to do things a little bit differently on this, which is that we love doing these extensive, highly researched, well-structured, yes, beautifully edited deep dives into the greatest films ever made. But John and I lately have been missing just having simple conversations about films. And yeah, that's why we're introducing this idea of Cinephiles One Takes.
Yeah, we should definitely give credit to our advisory board, because this was an issue. This was a something you and I had kind of been kicking around, and then we talked about it with our advisory board and got some great feedback from them. And even one of our advisory board members suggested the title, and we just kind of loved the title as soon as we heard it, and so did a lot of our advisory board. And it was a way of solving the problem. This is a show of solving the problem of us wanting to do more movies, because it was great. It's great to do these three-part, two-part breakdowns of movies, But there are movies that sometimes Steve and I just want to discuss. And, you know, we've been looking back after our 10-year anniversary of looking back on the old episodes from the first couple of seasons of the show. And I've been always amazed, and Steve has also felt this way over the years, how we were able to talk about these amazing films like an hour and 15 minutes or an hour and a half. And so we thought, well, since a lot of you tell us that those are some of your favorite episodes and you appreciate what we do now, we thought this would be a nice way after our 10-year anniversary to harken back to the bones of the Cinephiles, knock out more movies for you all to enjoy, and maybe encourage some of you to jump up in terms of the Patreon, because you'll be getting even more content and more bang for your buck ahead of time. And then, of course, those of you who are on the free tier and who get all of our episodes, you'll get these episodes just a week later. So it's kind of a way of us giving back overall, but also satisfying or scratching an itch that both of us have expressed over the last year to each other about the show, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we love doing these big deep dives, and we pick films that are worthy of really exploring to the most minute detail the movie. But honestly, sometimes John and I just want to talk about a movie. And the reason that we love a film isn't always that it is great. Like, we don't limit our... Sometimes you love a movie because you love a movie, and you think it'd be fun to discuss. So that's what we're going to do on Cinephiles One Takes. We are not necessarily going to go in order. We're certainly not going to go moment by moment. These are not researched to the most minute detail. And there will not be any fancy editing, or at least very, very little fancy editing in these episodes. This is just our opportunity to talk about a movie that we want to talk about. And as John said, they'll be released on the Patreon as well as on Apple Podcasts. And then a week later, they'll be in the regular podcast feed, so you can check it out there. So if you want it early, this is your opportunity to sign up for either Apple Podcasts or Patreon. But don't worry, you'll all be getting these episodes in the regular feed.
You know, this all started from where Steve texted me, or maybe we were having one of our chats. Sometimes we have off mic chats before we even start. Sometimes we have our off mic chats go so long that we don't even do the thing we said we were going to do for the day and push our recording to another day. But I think one of the first things that kind of got my mind going on this was Steve talking about wanting to talk about Wrath of Khan again. And I remember that was something that you had mentioned. And so it was something I said, we already did it, and we did such a deep dive with Mance. Would we want to revisit it? Would we want to talk about it? Maybe sometimes we're watching it late at night, we just want to jump on the mic and have a conversation about the movie.
Exactly.
So these are the kinds of things that you're going to get in the one takes, because they're literally going to be one takes. Now, it doesn't mean that we don't edit ourselves at stumbling around or whatever, but it will essentially be our one take for that day about that movie. And it could be anything. And I think it opens up the door for us to talk about also some of the movies that some of you all have as either guilty pleasures or that you love that you know would never make it in the regular Cinephiles rotation, but you're still going to hear us talk about it, and we can hear from you all about what you think about these movies as well. And should we introduce the movie, Steve, or is there anything more to say?
No, I think absolutely we should introduce the movie. Let's go.
All right, so the first movie we're doing in honor of the World Cup just ending over the weekend, with Spain beating Argentina 1-0 in extra time, is Victory, or for some of our European and international listeners, Escape to Victory. This one directed by John Huston and written by Yabo Yablonsky and Evan Jones, produced by Freddie Fields, who had also produced Glory, Millennium, Crimes of the Heart, The Year of Living Dangerously, American Gigolo, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Holy Moses, which I think was Dudley Moore's attempt at The Life of Brian.
Oh,
And he was the executive producer for 1,061 episodes of The Montel Williams Show. That's who executive produced this movie. And it stars Michael Caine, Sylvester Stallone, Max von Sydow, and the Brazilian legend, Pelé. It's set in World War II, and it basically focuses on a team of POWs who are convinced to have a match with the German national team under the Nazi rule in a stadium in Paris, and essentially being turned into a publicity op for the Nazis to show how superior they are to the Allied forces in this match. But of course, this has a lot of shades of The Great Escape, a lot of shades of Rocky. And this is about that time, the early 80s, when you had these interesting sports movies that weren't your conventional sports movies, like Chariots of Fire and other films, like Personal Best even, And so this is one that has been a guilty pleasure of mine for many, many years for a number of reasons. And Steve was very gracious to be open for this being our first episode to discuss this movie. So, Steve, I don't even know how we start other than to say, what is your experience with Victory? What are your feelings about this movie? What was it like revisiting it again to talk about it for this show?
It's so funny, and we've talked about this many times, is there was this time where we didn't get to pick what we watched. There was just what was on. And I don't know if it was on Showtime or some local channel, but there was a certain period where Victory was on all the time.
Yeah.
So I watched it a bunch in the early 80s. My guess is, you know, because I would see a movie, I wouldn't catch the beginning. I'd start in the middle. I'd watch the rest. I'd see the beginning, but then I had to go to Little League practice or whatever it was. But I probably watched this a half a dozen or a dozen times, you know, not all in one sitting, and then never watched it again until just recently. So it's probably 30 plus years between when I saw it and then seeing it again just a few nights ago. And it's so fun. I think there are many things that could be better in this movie. And I totally, totally enjoyed it. Like, and particularly when you get to the end in the soccer match at the end. I teared up when Pele did the kick. I was moved by it. I was rooting for the team, knowing absolutely nothing about soccer. It seemed like the play was really exciting to me. And yet all the way through, there was like, well, why did they do it that way? That seems like a strange choice. I mean, it's like, it's funny too, because by the way, this is our first John Huston movie.
Oh my God.
I know. And it's like, John Huston, I mean, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, African Queen, Maltese Falcon. There's so many incredible movies. We're starting, he's heading. He's not quite headed out to pasture, but I don't think he was 100% dialed in for this movie. But this is why I'm glad we're doing it on one takes, because you don't have to, it doesn't have to be a great film to be a film that you love and a film that you enjoy. And I totally, totally enjoyed revisiting this one.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it has all the nostalgic magic that a lot of these 80s films still have for me. And by the way, not all of them hold up anymore when I rewatched them, but this one did. Watching it again, it was surprisingly more interesting than I remember it being, because it has been I haven't seen it since 2019, because I saw it on the plane ride back from England when Lindley and I went for 10 days in 2019 to visit England and the UK. And I just remember loving it again. And then watching it again, I was ready to be cynical about the movie, but it has a charm to it that is really hard to explain, other than it walks that line of about serious stakes, serious issues. It evokes some of the great classic films like The Great Escape or Rocky, while also having a pretty rousing score done by Bill Conti, who did the Rocky movies and did apparently 10 movies with Stallone doing the scores for them. And there are shades of this, of how he did the score here, that influences how he does the score in The Right Stuff 2 or 3 years later. So there's a lot about this. And then you've got Pele. For me, that was the big soccer player. For a lot of you who are watching us who are younger, like Messi or Ronaldo was the soccer player you know as the greatest. For me, I grew up with Pele. And in a South American household, like I grew up in here in the States with my parents who were immigrants, they spoke about Pele all the time. My dad spoke about Pele all the time. So the fact that he was doing a movie, and I was a massive Sylvester Stallone fan because of Rocky as a young kid. So it kind of was this movie that was really important for me and my dad in our communication as a young kid and connection as father and son. And I dragged him to DC to see this movie and just fell in love with it. And seeing Pele, seeing Max von Sydow, seeing Michael Caine, who I'd gotten to know in the 70s as well from some films he'd done. So like, it was just a great combination, and it all worked. It just, in some crazy way, it really works. And there are a lot of bad soccer films, Steve. This one is not in the bad soccer film category, because it's about something. And there are twists and turns in this film that are surprising. And there's humor throughout this that doesn't take away from the serious stakes, which I think is a very tough line to walk at times as well.
Hey, Cinephiles fans, this is John. Well, summer is here, and it's time to take those special moments to kind of sit back and relax a little bit and enjoy the season. I'm talking about barbecues, pool days, road trips, heading out to the beach, heading out to the lake, going to the golf course, family gathering nights, or even late nights out in the backyard. And the best way to enjoy those nights is with a good cigar. Thompson Cigar can help you with that. They have been America's humidor since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at the lowest prices. They are a trusted source for cigar lovers seeking quality and value. With one of the largest humidors in America, Thompson guarantees fresh cigars shipped right to your door. And they offer a variety of unique five-pack fever deals, and value clubs offer unbeatable savings and curated experiences that keep customers just like you coming back for more. And I've already tried a couple of Thompson cigars, and they are so well made and solid. The outer leaf looks smooth and supple, and the taste of these cigars are like a meal. They have such complexity, and they burn slowly and evenly. This is an excellent cigar. Use our code CINEPHILES at checkout for up to 20% off your order of $75 or more. Or visit www.thompsoncigar.com/cinephiles. That's CINEPHILES. And the discount will automatically apply. Some exclusions apply.
By the way, I have what might very well be a false memory. I am not sure of this. I definitely know that I went to see, I've seen, I think, two soccer games in person. One was the LA women's team, and I don't even remember the name of the team, but it was really fun. Went to see it, see them a couple of years ago. And the
LAFC, right, Angel City FC.
Right. And the other was when I was a little kid, I think on like a Cub Scout trip, we went to see a soccer game, and the part of the false, what might be a false memory, I'm pretty sure I went to a soccer game. I mean, I can remember that. But my memory was that Pele was there as kind of an exhibition. And I went and looked up. Yes, he was, did two exhibitions in like 74 and 76, which is when I was in Cub Scouts in San Jose. Right. So I don't know if, but I really don't know if I actually saw him or didn't see him. But even as a non-soccer guy, I knew who Pele was. I mean, we used to watch the Wide World of Sports. You know, these, again, these things that people don't know about. And the Wild World, you'd see rock climbing and you'd see ping pong and you see all these things. And I remember the, I knew before I saw Victory, I knew who Pele was. I knew about the bicycle kick, you know? Yeah. And so like I was prime, you know, I mean, he was such a huge force, you know, that has to be a gigantic, The spotlight on that guy had to be so huge for some kid in Marin County, California, who knew nothing about soccer to 100% know who that guy was.
Yeah, people think social media is what blew people up. But the truth is, people have blown up all the time throughout history. And it all depends on the time and the decade and the situation. Pele, a Muhammad Ali in the 70s, and I would argue probably Steve Bruce Jenner as well. And these were internationally known names, international superstars. And sadly, OJ Simpson as well was someone who was really well known in the late 70s into the 80s. And for all his like the commercials and then getting into the movies, like there were just certain athletes that were just transcendent in their charm or personality. And they just had that it factor. Pele was one of those guys. And, you know, I sent Steve a clip on YouTube that I found from 1980 where Stallone and Pele are at the Soccer Bowl of 1980, which was the NASL Super Bowl, which was the old soccer league and before the MLS, the North American Soccer League. This was essentially their Super Bowl. And the halftime was Pele and Stallone being interviewed about Victory. And it is so cheesy. You can find it on YouTube. Maybe we'll post it on the Facebook page. The graphics are insane. Keith Jackson does the intro, and I think he gets Pele's name wrong and how he says it. And it's just so funny all around. And Jim McKay does the interview. And Jim, as you said, Steve, so well, Wild World of Sports. Jim was known for the Wild World of Sports. So it was such a fascinating thing to see this time in the 1981, where they're trying to promote soccer to the wider American audience. You know, there has been this desire to have soccer breakthrough for years. And this film was supposed to be another step forward to try to get people on board with soccer in the States, you know, because international players had been starting to come over and play for the NASL during the 70s and early 80s.
By the way, one thing that's so funny watching this movie seems to me to be so much a movie put together by a producer.
not yes, a movie yeah. put together by a director. Like, this is like, yeah. hey, guys, I think we can get Pele. And then, you know, this other moment of like, can we put Stallone in it? You know, yeah. like, just this, let's put these. It's a, this movie feels to some degree assembled.
Yes.
You know, as much as like the vision of someone who like, I really want to tell this story, you know?
Yeah. Oh, no, listen, John Huston has been clear that he does not like this movie. He does not, he wishes the movie would go away. He apparently was only on set for certain scenes and that, was not that makes there for sense. Everything. Yeah, he shot none of the soccer scenes, apparently. That was all second unit and choreographed by Pele. That was one of the conditions for Pele to come on the film, is that he would choreograph the soccer plays. Which is very funny when you see in the movie him breaking down or interrupting Michael Caine's character as he's trying to deliver tactics. And it's just like, just give me the ball and I'm going to go around everybody and score. And so you saw, so a lot of that was done by Pele and the second unit director. Even Stallone's escape scene, Huston reportedly left halfway through the shooting and just went back to his trailer and let the second unit handle it, which broke Stallone's heart because Stallone took the job to work with John Huston. To be a part of this. And you say, put together, Freddie Fields. This is how Stallone got on the film. In 1979, Stallone was looking to buy a beach house in Malibu. One of the houses he looked at was owned by Freddie Fields. Freddie Fields lets him look around the house while he sits out on the sun deck. When Stallone comes out to tell him that he thinks the house is too small for him, that he doesn't want the house, Freddie then pitches Stallone Victory. Tells him the story of the new film he wanted to tell. And he happened to have a script with him.
Just happened.
You're right, Steve. You know this. Yeah. Stallone is massive, coming out of Rocky, and it's 1980. I mean, he's had a couple of misfires with Fist, and I can't remember what the other film was after that. But like, so Freddie has the script with him, as you said, probably staged, and gives him the script. And Stallone, 3 days later, signs on to work on the film. So I think you're absolutely right. This is John Huston's like right on the tail end of his career. So get him for what you can get him for. Get Pele in this. You get Michael Caine, and Michael Caine, who had worked with John Huston in The Man Who Would Be King, so right. wanted to reunite with John Huston and wanted to work with Pele, wanted to be in a film with Pele because he was a massive fan of soccer as well. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right in looking at this film as something that was put together by a producer for sure.
It makes sense, by the way. So one of the things I wrote down was when Stallone escapes, and this is exactly why this is a cinephile one take, because yeah. I am now doing what we would never do when we do the regular show, which is I'm going to talk about a scene way yeah. later in the movie, right at the beginning. Yeah. But when Stallone escapes and he finds the resistance and he meets the woman of the resistance, yeah. I'm watching yeah. the scene and I was writing like the eye line. So eye line is the sense that you could tell that somebody is looking at another person. The eye line is terrible. The way the shots are put together, and this is like basic filmmaking. And so when you say that Huston went back to his trailer, that makes perfect sense because that scene, and it's so funny because I understand what the scene is supposed to be, you know, which is there's this attraction and there's this tension and what is all this stuff, except that scene does not play well because it doesn't even look like they're in the same. I mean, it's really weird the way it's staged and filmed.
Yeah, agreed. And the actress there, Carol Lore, she's still alive. She's a writer, director, and song artist. She is not French. She was born in Canada in Quebec. So you could argue French-Canadian, but sure. not French national. And so I think, Steve, though, something that never occurred to me, and I've watched the film probably 5 million times, watching it this time, no, honestly, on VHS, beta, I owned it on beta and watched it religiously.
Wow.
That's how much I love the film. And there's no 4K version, which is a fucking crime right now. But this is a French Adrian. Yeah, so when you talk about putting together a film by a producer, they find someone who kind of evokes the Adrian thing, who looks almost exactly like Talia Shire. She's a little shy, but she's also strong, and they have the back and forth, but she has a child. So there's sympathy immediately. But like when they hug at the end, when he's going back to the prison, it's almost like they've had this whole relationship in the movie that we've never seen because they've got this very strong connection, which is so weird, right?
You're just kind of being told You know, here's an attractive man and an attractive woman. They were in a room together. Yes. Therefore, this must be a relationship. I mean, it's the movie's so funny too, because what you said about The Great Escape, that was literally the first thing I wrote down.
Yeah,
they 100%. Sat. Whoever wrote this script, like, watched The Great Escape 20 times, and they took like, here's a little and it so much falls into the really what you shouldn't do, which is that a lot of people do their research for their, you know, their prisoner of war movie or whatever movie by watching other prisoner of war movies, which isn't actually research. You know, it's, you can see that. And Hilt and Stallone is Hilt. Yeah. He is Steve McQueen to the point where he is forced to escape and return to the camp, which is what Hilt does in Great Escape. And, and all of it, and even sort of there's the moment with Hilt in Great Escape where he has the plan of sticking up tubes through the dirt and tunneling under in order to breathe. And they're like, oh, it's so brilliant, it could almost work. And that's really how Stallone's escape is treated. It's exactly the same thing. You know what I mean? And there's so many. But honestly, if I have a first time screenwriting student in class, I will tell them to, like, if you don't understand structure, if you don't have that natural thing, take a couple of films in your genre and understand how the beats are playing. Mm. Don't copy them exactly, but now you kind of understand. It'll hopefully give you a sense. I mean, my first screenplay, actually, that's what I did. My first screenplay I ever wrote was a remake of Akira Kurosawa's first film, which is Sanshiro Sugata. Very simple movie. And I just wanted a simple template where I could understand the structure. And then I changed who the characters were and what was going on. But it really helped me to learn about structure. That being said, this is very Great Escapey, you know?
It really is. Yeah, someone broke it down here. I'm going to read this real quick with the Great Escape connections. Tim Pigott-Smith, who is the second in command there, is like Richard Attenborough's character. Julian Corey like James Donald. Clive Merrison, a cross between Donald Pleasance being the forger and James Garner with his resilient manner. Amadou is like Charles Bronson, who is Amadou is the French guy, the lead French guy. Mm. He is like Charles Bronson, who is the concentrated tunneler. And of course, Sylvester Stallone is Steve McQueen, with the friendly German Max von Sydow is like Hans Messner. And Michael Caine is the only lead character that only fits this movie's plotline. But I would say, in watching this again, it's just why I'm so happy we're doing this, just have conversations about this. It struck me that Michael Caine's character is a lot like Alec Guinness in The Bridge on the River Kwai. They're constantly telling him, what you're doing working with the enemy, London's not going to like it. England's not going to like it. Stallone, in a lot of ways, is like the guy who is constantly trying to tell him, like, what do you do? The guy who keeps breaking back into the camp is like telling him, what are you doing? Why are you doing this stuff? Why are you helping them? So there is an element of that to Michael Caine's performance here, that these guys are trying to tell him, you're treating this like it's a regular soccer game, like it's no big deal to play the Nazis. And we're trying to tell you there is political ramifications to what you're doing. And neither one of them is clean, because clearly the Germans want to do it to exploit the fact that they can beat these POWs, prisoners of war, and show a German superiority. But the British on the other side want to use it to show the German weakness, because all these players could escape at halftime. So there are ulterior motives on both sides. And Michael Caine, in a lot of ways, even though he's not understanding the British side of what their issues are with it, he's trying to be a sportsman of the game. He's trying to stand for what the game is supposed to symbolize. So in a lot of ways, I think watching it as an adult, this film moves me, because in a world now, Steve, we've talked about on the show and on off mic, like a world so separated by two sides who have ulterior motives, it feels like the desire to be in this middle, to stand by principles and morals and ethics and stand for something good in terms of the connection between human beings here, that's something to be explored, because even Max von Sydow's character is doing it for the sport, in honor of the sport to a degree. So they're the two men just kind of standing for the principles here, while other people are using nefarious motives for their own reasons for this whole thing going down. So I think that's a fascinating thing I discovered watching the movie this time around after such a long time.
So first of all, Max von Sydow, not unsurprisingly, steals every scene that he's in.
Oh, 1,000,000%. Yes.
I mean, the guy's so great. You talk about, like, who are the actors you wish you could have worked with. Max von Sydow is one of the actors. I would, you know, there were so many things you could cast him in. What's so great about his character, and I agree with everything you said, is that what we get is He's an honorable man who deeply loves soccer in exactly the way that Michael Caine, maybe even loves soccer more than Michael Caine. Like he believes that there is something important and ethical about the friendly competition within the sport by the rules.
Right.
By the and I don't think this is what's so interesting about the movie. It's totally there. And then Michael Caine doesn't quite know when to whether or not he can trust them, and then decides to trust him. And Max von Sydow believes that it is possible to have a pure sporting event between the Germans and the POWs, and then is betrayed by the Germans and realizes it's not going to be fair. And then Michael Caine feels betrayed by Max von Sydow, who he felt he understood and had promised him something. It's all there.
Yeah,
it doesn't quite hit. There was one more scene. There was one more rewrite. Yeah. If they had had one more scene together, because every time they're on screen together, it's really interesting.
Yeah,
if there was this scene where they actually laugh together, you know what I mean? Yeah. Where they what's cool about it is, which I of course believe, is that in general people are people, and even most of the Germans, even when they were fighting for the Nazis, that doesn't mean Max von Sydow was a Nazi who wanted to eradicate the Jews and conquer the world.
All right.
He was a soccer player who went to serve his country, you know?
Yes, right.
And so it's how I feel about so many things, where it's like, that is almost there, you know?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm telling you, when Max von Sydow stands up when there's with the Marseillaise, when the team wins, and you see just cutting to the reaction shots of him, A, seeing the betrayals when the refs are going against them and the nasty hits and the violence and all that, and his shame at watching this, and then the sheer joy. Because he loves the game, you know?
Well, yeah. The fact that he played on the German national team, I think, is really important. If those scenes, and remember when they bring in the other German guy who played against Kolbe, back in the as well, there's like this kind of camaraderie between them. Like, politics separates them. The pitch doesn't.
Right.
Politics separates them. And so there's something that's, and of course, the abhorrent things that the Nazis did, of course, that's something to highlight. And it gets highlighted in this movie really well, I believe. And so you have these conversations, but you see, and even Max von Sydow, when he is his character, when he's pitching the game, he says that to the Germans who are like, well, we need to stomp them to pieces. And he's like, no, listen, this is good because we're all going to have to live in this Europe after this war is over. So his mind is like, we all got to learn to get along, even though we think we're going to win the war and we'll be the ruling power of Europe. We've got to learn to live together. So even in some misguided principle of his, because I don't think he really understands how horrible the Nazis are. We're not led to believe that he is like ignoring it, right? That he's even uncomfortable when Michael Caine requests the Eastern European players. He doesn't want to initially do it because he says, well, Germany doesn't recognize them at all, right? And he's basically talking about, I think he's referencing people in the concentration camps and Jews possibly. So it's a very interesting thing when you see all of that going down here, but he acquiesces. He brings in the players, right? Yep. And it's the Brits who are mad about it. It's the Brits who are like, why are you doing this? What is ridiculous? He's screwing you by bringing in these skeletons, right? So these two men of principle are fighting throughout the whole movie for each side to understand that this is actually the better approach to things. Even von Sydow in the first interactions with Michael Caine says, if only we could solve our problems on the pitch. It's a bit naive, but I like the idealism of it, you know, because it's not like countries don't fight on the pitch. We're just leaving a World Cup final where Argentina was clearly trying to have physical altercations with the Spain players. So that, you know, so there's elements of that I think that stood out to me this time watching it, Steve, that really surprised me.
Well, and you know, you'll get no argument from me, which at some point we're going to have to learn to live together, you know?
Right, right.
Like we cannot limit the world to only the people that agree with us. And I think sports is one of the great places that happens.
I agree. Yeah.
You know,
well, that's why the Olympics and that's why the World Cup is always so important, because people come together and see each other's cultures and see each other's uniqueness, but also see all the things that connect us, all the things that make us human beings are relatable and universal. the difference is, oh, I come from a different country or a different culture, but I still love and hate and fear and get excited and am joyful. All these things are there, you know, and I think that's what's so great coming out of these experiences. I do want to talk about the genesis of this movie, Steve, because this is a fascinating situation when you look at it. First of all, the film was filmed in Hungary. It is based on the 1962 Hungarian film drama, Two Half-Times in Hell, which was directed by Zoltán Fabry and won the Critics Award at the 1962 Boston Cinema Festival. It was inspired by a since-disproven story about a series of games in Kiev during the German occupation of the city. Several members of the Dynamo Kiev Soccer Club, which is still a club that is very powerful there in the Ukraine, found work in a bakery. Then they formed a football team with other bakery employees. They began playing in a new league against teams supported by the Ukrainian puppet government and the German military. After they beat a team from a local German Air Force base, the league was disbanded and several of the team members were arrested by the Gestapo and four were executed. That's the legend of the story. But the true story is actually more complex, as the team played a series of matches against German teams, and they were victorious in all of them before any of them were sent to the prison camps by the Gestapo. Four players were documented as killed by the Germans, but long after the dates of the matches they had won. So it's not connected to the matches. But I think it's fascinating that in honor of the original story, they shot in Hungary for 5 weeks, this entire film, and used one of the stadiums there as a stand-in for the Germans, the Paris stadium we get to by the end of the movie. So there is a basis, in fact, for this story, even if it has shades of other World War II movies. It is based in some semblance of a story that happened during occupation of World War II by the Nazis.
Well, and it can't help but make me think of the famous, also to some degree, my understanding, apocryphal story of the soccer match between the lines during World War One on Christmas Day.
Right.
And so,
right.
You know, there's a Rest of This History podcast on it. And my memory of that podcast is that story isn't exactly really what happened, it's such a lovely notion.
Yeah.
One thing I want to get back to, one of the other things that I feel like I really wish there had been more of was those Eastern European prisoners, because they bring them in and they have that argument and say, like, what is the point of this? And we're just feeding them. And then as far as I remember, we never see them again.
No, we don't. Well, they said they're on the bench, but they never come on to the pitch, I don't think.
I really wanted to meet him. I would have loved that moment where Michael Caine walked up to him and walked up to Michael Caine. I would do it this way. He comes up and says hello, and Michael Caine doesn't recognize him because he's so thin and so ill.
Oh, right, and that he maybe played against him in the past.
That he played against him, and that this was one of the great players. And then what I would have done, after the penalties and Pele's injured, put one of them in, put that guy in.
Yeah.
And he's sick and he makes one fucking great play. You know what I mean? Like he does one thing. You have a redemptive mode. That was sort of my thing, is that plants and payoffs. Like, it was like, oh, you could have just done it's throughout the whole movie. I'm like, if you'd done just a little bit more, this actually could have been a great movie. And it doesn't quite, it keeps getting close, but not quite.
Right. Well, they changed the script.
Oh, really?
So the film you're talking about was actually the original approach to the film. Yabo Jablonski, by the way, what an incredible
great name.
Yeah, right? For a screenwriter especially, you know. His original script was much darker. This is the script that convinced Stallone to do the movie, actually. The original script was much darker, with the POWs and exploring what happens with the Nazis. And it was much more morose. Stallone wanted the camp to be very, dreary. And he wanted that whole feeling of what it actually would be like to be in a prisoner of war camp and experiencing this stuff. The humor was brought in, I think. These were the revisions that were done by Freddie Fields to the script to make it more of a populist film that still honored the fact that it was the Nazis, still honored that there were people from concentration camps and the peril of the Nazis, but also had a rousing ending. Right. It wasn't intended to be this way originally. And Stallone apparently was very upset about it and fought against it. But, you know, the changes are the changes, and they went with these changes. But you can tell there's a lighter approach to this film than what Yabo intended. And apparently when he saw the movie at the premieres, he was so upset that he almost took his own life out of anger of what they had done to his script, because wow. the script, because the film had been so important to him, to as an indictment of the Nazis, an indictment of fascism, an indictment of what happens to people from all nations who are put under the foot of authority and the boot of authority. And so for him, he felt that they treated it way too lightly throughout the movie, because this is a sports film. It's not an anti-Nazi film,
right.
overwhelmingly, you know, and I think that's something that I could totally understand. So what you're talking about might have actually happened in the original script, but there were a lot of revisions apparently made to make it more accessible. So
by the way, having that happen to me, it is not fun. Mm. You know, you write a script and then 6 months later you see the movie and going like, what the fuck is this? There's one movie that I wrote that stars Lance Hendrickson and some other people, that low budget action movie. And I only watched it once. I had to get drunk to do it. It was so.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh no. Oh my God. Oh, it was one of the most painful things I've ever seen. Cause they really were saying mostly my words, but they didn't mean what they were supposed to mean. Like they entirely missed the point throughout the whole thing. Yeah. It was awful.
Well, some of the players, but I don't think you would have gotten the international players that you got for this movie if you had made it, you know, a dour commentary on Nazis and prisoners of war. Because the film starred professional footballer, not only Pele, but Bobby Moore was in this. He was the captain of the England team that won the World Cup in 1966. Osvaldo Ardiles, who was part of the team that won the World Cup for Argentina in 1978. Casimir Dana was in this. Paul Van Himst, Mike Summerby, Halvar Thorsen, Werner Roth, who was a star at the time in the NASL. He's the German captain, the penalty taker at the end, the one who scores the most goals for the German team. And numerous Ipswich Town players were in the film, including John Wark, Russell Osman, Laurie Savell, Robin Turner, Kevin O'Callaghan as well. And in the football scenes, Kevin Beatty was the body double for Michael Caine, because Michael Caine was 47 years old at the time we made this movie. And Pele said he couldn't run for more than 5 minutes during the games that they had, because they had some mock games. And Paul Cooper stood in for Sylvester Stallone. And Stallone was trained by the World Cup winning goalkeeper for the Britain team in 1966, Gordon Banks. And apparently he didn't want to listen to what he was being trained to do. And so he just kind of started, because of course, the cockiness of Stallone, he just started playing goalkeeper. He separated his shoulder, broke a rib, and broke a finger. And then he started listening to the training and the condition. He still broke one more rib afterwards, but he was much more careful in how he played. And apparently this is the height of Stallone's arrogance. He was rarely on set, apparently, and was writing Rocky III at the time. So he wouldn't come to the set, Steve, unless they were absolutely ready to shoot his scene. So he would show up, do the scene, and go right back to his trailer. He didn't eat with any of the other actors, so that caused division and issues throughout the whole time. Michael Caine apparently hated working with him on that particular set. So, you know, of course, later he redoes Get Carter as the Michael Caine character. So, yeah.
So I, in my opinion, you can't be pissed off that your director is not coming to set to direct you when you're acting like a prima donna. That is my opinion. Let me ask you this. I can't think of anything. Yeah. Has there ever been a movie? Because it's from your descriptions of the players, these are world-class players.
100%. Yes.
Has there ever been a sports movie where the most of the sports, including arguably one of the greatest soccer players, if not one of the greatest athletes in the history of the world? I think when they had it was like a athlete of the millennia, and Pele was definitely in the top five. Has there ever been a movie that had that kind of murderer's row of real athletes doing the sport in a movie? I can't think of anything.
Well, you're not going to like my answer, but there is an answer.
Yeah.
And it's called Space Jam, because it had Michael Jordan.
Oh, you're right.
Right?
Yep. Yeah,
Michael
there you
Jordan
go.
And all the top NBA players at the time, Patrick Ewing, all the guys.
No, that's great. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's correlative to to answer your question. Yeah. But it's a rarity. It's a rarity to get all the athletes to be a part of this thing. So, I thought that was fascinating about it. What did you think about the Pele situation? How did you find Pele in the movie? He is Trinidadian in the movie because they wanted to be historically accurate, Steve. Brazil had not joined the Allied forces by the time this movie came out, or the time the movie is set right? They didn't join until 1944. I think this movie set in 1942. So what did you think about Pele's performance in the movie and the scenes he got to play here throughout the whole film, especially that critical moment at the, in the halftime when he convinces them to go back and play the game?
So I had a memory of what the movie was.
Yes.
And a memory of Pele, and I think I had built up sort of a story behind it, and then I had a very different reaction when I watched it. What my memory was that, Pele couldn't act, and Pele didn't speak English well, and therefore that's why he doesn't have a lot of to do in the film.
Right.
Watching it, I thought Pele was really good. I mean, you know, for an athlete, I went... And I really think they blew it. I think they could have given him so much more to do. Like he shows up and there's some, they allow him to play.
Yes.
They should have done a whole thing. They should have had one of the players be racist or disrespectful.
Oh,
because there's both and go like, this guy can't play. And then just have Pele destroy him and then have him destroy three other guys and then have the team realize, holy shit, we've got, you know, a great player, but they never really do that. He's not really doing very much for most of the film. And then there's a feeling at the end, because he says something to Stallone that changes Stallone's mind. And the feeling of that moment is that they're friends, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But we never saw friendship. We never saw that relationship. And so and I also go like, well, Pele should have been teaching Stallone how to play.
Right.
You know, like that's what should have been like, and the whole way they do the Stallone thing, like we meet him, he's already playing with the team, but I don't quite understand why.
Yeah.
And then it's really important for him to play with the team, I guess, because it'll help him escape, because maybe when they're out, he'll get to escape or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit confusing. I mean, like his whole relationship to soccer, because when you see him playing with the team in the very beginning, you don't get the sense like this guy has no idea what he's doing. You get the sense of like he's playing with the team. And and you got to pick a lane. Like either he has played soccer before and knows what he's doing, or he hasn't played soccer before and doesn't. And then, you know, the process of him learning, and it's all the Stallone stuff it's really strange, because then you have the trainer thing. Then you have the whole like him competing with Michael Caine, like trying to be the co-leader of the team, which is a funny scene, but it's kind of weird. And then I think the choice of we need a goalkeeper and it has to be Stallone is like perfectly cheesy Americanness. You know what I mean? And that is not a criticism. That is a compliment. That is like, yes, of course that's what we have to do. But then when we're in the train with Michael Caine and he goes, can you tell me how to be a goalie, essentially? And Michael Caine doesn't tell him anything. And and Michael Caine's whole motivation is he cares about the game. He doesn't care about the escape. That's what we've learned. Why would you not tell your goalie how the things that he's asking you when he's, I mean, my understanding is a goalie's a kind of important player on the team. But later on, he does tell him the thing that he didn't tell him before for no reason I can understand. And they kind of laugh together. And it's like, I wanted there to be a relationship that progresses between the two of them. And again, this is my comment about the whole movie. It's kind of there.
Yes.
But it's not really there.
Right. I think in this kind of a movie, star power is doing all the work.
Yeah.
And your desire to see them be friends with each other is overriding what you're supposed to do in a movie like this, movie like this, right? Because Stallone and Pele have such an easy camaraderie from the beginning, especially when he does that penalty kick scene, that you're just like, oh, these guys have been, like you said, but it's our love of them as stars that makes us kind of overlook this other stuff. And you're so right. Like, there's a whole list of goofs that this film has. If you look at it and look at how this all is staged, you're like, none of this should work. None of this has any business working. But in the end it does. That overhead kick that you have brought up a couple times, man, that took three takes to get right. Because in the first take, the goalie saved it by instinct.
Oh, really?
Yes. And the second take, it went way over. And then the third take, there was no way he was saving that goal the way they put it together. And there's a great oral history on Victory. Honestly, this could be a three-hour conversation. Because they interviewed...
No, this is a one take. We're not doing that.
No, you're right. There's a website, radiofreesoccer.com/victory. There's an oral history where they interviewed a number of the players to talk about their experiences on making the film and talk about the film. There is too much to have included in this one take, but there was a lot of things in here that I think are very common to what they're saying, which is basically they were on set for 12 hours a day. They had a lot of downtime, so they played a lot of football with each other.
Yeah.
And were kicking a ball around. So there was a lot of time. So I think that must have been amazing to be on a set with all of these incredible footballers just telling stories about their games or playing football with each other the whole time. And just all of that, I think for me, if I was a PA on this set, I would have been in heaven to sit with this many amazing football minds and just watch them play the game at the top level they could play. And with Pelé, who was still, you know, just not that far removed from leaving the game completely, that could still do it and play the way he wanted to play. So, but I'm going to break your heart about Pelé.
Mm.
That is not Pelé's voice that you hear in the film.
Oh,
Pelé was dubbed because his English was not that strong. So they hired an American actor to dub his film, to dub his voice throughout the movie. And actually quite a few of the English actors or the British actors who had stronger accents were dubbed over them, especially the Irish actors were dubbed over in the movie as well, so that you could understand some of the dialogue. Not that they had a lot of dialogue, but some of the dialogue and those random comments that they were making. I'll tell you one thing that breaks that when I watched the movie this time around, Steve, you talk about things that you wish you had. I wish we had much more time with the players, the ball busting, the joshing, the play, you know, encouraging each other. That would have been a lot of fun. But I imagine they didn't want to do too much of that, possibly because that would have made it seem more fun. And this film had to constantly remind you that we are dealing with the Nazis and World War II and concentration camps and subjugation of a people in a country like France. So you had to be reminded of it all the time. And I think they did an excellent job casting all three, the Germans, the English, and the French.
Oh, they're
all
great.
They did a great job casting these actors who were good actors in their respective countries.
I think the thing with the players is they're, until we get to the game, they're non-characters.
Yes.
They're right? Essentially background. And then when we get to the game, and again, I will say it again, I thought the sports, the play was really exciting. Pelé did a great job choreographing it. I was engaged. It was thrilling. It was brutal at times. I had all the emotions of, oh, they almost scored, and oh, he's injured and all that stuff. I thought that was working great. It would have been, I think, giving those, I mean, this is what's really hard to do, as we talked many, many times on the Cinephiles, movies that can give a character a moment in two or three lines where you go, oh, I get that guy.
Yeah.
That's actually extremely difficult to do, but I really wish I knew those players going in. I wish I knew that this one, you know, is super fast on the outside, or this one can do this, or just a couple of things. Yeah. So that I could see, or like I knew, you know, there, because again, it's not setting up Pelé well enough. If you had set up Pelé really, really well, and like, this is the unstoppable guy, he is our secret to winning. And then he gets injured. I mean, I know that he's the secret to winning because I know that's Pelé, but it's not in the movie, you know? And so like, I really would have loved to see the interplay with those characters. Mm-hmm. And the thing too, I would say, I mean, honestly, this is a movie that is phoned in by a bunch of people. It sounds like most importantly, John Huston is that if you had someone, and I don't know if he likes soccer, I don't know if he, you know, but to me, what you described of all the guys playing between takes and stuff like that, if I were the director on this film, I would have gone and watched it and I would have talked to them. Yeah. Like the only, like, if, you know, it's like, I don't care about soccer. If I got a gig where I was going to make a soccer movie, I would immerse myself in soccer for months and months, because the only way to make that movie is to love soccer, you know? Like, so I would have to fall in love with it. You have to fall in love with your material. I don't think John Huston fell in love with this, you know?
No, it was very clear. Yeah, that's the thing I discovered in the research as well, that John Huston was not a soccer fan, had never watched a game, had never played a game, and wasn't that big of a fan of it. So that was the approach he took. And I think you're right to sense that comes off the screen with how he directs the movie, for sure, Steve. Here are the people who are possibly going to be in the movie. Lloyd Bridges was possibly going to play the Michael Caine character. Clint Eastwood was eyed for the Sylvester Stallone character. French actor Alain Delon was probably going to play the tunneler in the film as well. But Roger Moore is who they were in serious talks with for the Michael Caine character or Michael Caine part before Caine accepted it. I think that's a completely different movie with Roger Moore. Probably doesn't even run Roger Moore. Just take the ball and put it that way. I don't know that he would do that, you know?
I don't have any sense of Roger Moore, honestly, as an actor other than The Saint and James Bond. Like, yeah, exactly. So I don't know. He could be an amazing actor. I have no idea. The other thing I was thinking about is that Michael Caine in the late 60s and 70s made a whole bunch of great, interesting films.
Yes.
The Man Who Would Be King is a fantastic movie. That is another thing I would do as a Cinephile's one take. That to me might be the last really great John Huston movie. Then in the 80s, you get to this era where there was the joke about Michael Caine that he would do anything for a paycheck. And he started showing up everywhere. This movie feels like he's totally 100% doing the job that is required. It feels to me like, and maybe part of this is the changes in the script that Stallone was upset about, is Michael Caine showed up and he goes, okay, I'm doing what now? Okay, I'll do that. Yeah. And then and he's great. He's fine. You know, there's nothing wrong with his performance, but it is definitely one of many relatively forgettable Michael Caine performances.
Right. You know, and listen, in reading this oral history from a lot of these players, a lot of them say the ones who weren't as well known as Pele, and Bobby Moore, a lot of them say that the number one thing they are known for is this movie, not their careers. They get asked about it all the time. They're at charity golf things and get asked about it all the time because people still discover this movie, still love this movie. And I think that's the enduring power of it, is that it has gone on for generations and generations and multiple generations within international countries and our country as well. People talk about Victory all the time because of the power of this. What did you feel about Stallone throughout the movie, though, Steve? Like, was an American who was serving in the Canadian Army and was essentially captured. But he is, like, this is Stallone. This is peak Stallone, right? I mean, there's a charm to him. There's a swagger to him. He's attractive. I like that he's the underdog here because he can't play the game. He's constantly being rejected by Colby, the Michael Caine character. Yet he's skilled in what he does in escaping. And has to be sent back. And he has the running gag throughout the whole movie. This soccer game is ruining my life. So, like, what are your thoughts on him throughout the movie? And especially leading to that critical moment at the end when he saves the penalty. Like, that is full Stallone looking in you in the eye of the eye of the tiger. Like, it's incredible. What were your thoughts on him?
Well, let's start where you ended. Because that moment is so much like, how do we get a little more Rocky? We need more Rocky in this movie because does that ever happen in a soccer game where someone comes up and mad dogs them right before a penalty tick?
Okay. 100%.
Okay. I didn't know.
It's the referee's job to push the goalie away, but goalies will walk up to that spot and try to say stuff, try to look you in the eye. They do all kinds of stuff to intimidate you now. Yeah.
I think this is perfectly exactly how this movie should go, which is he has to stop the penalty kick. And we saw him struggle. I thought the stuff during the game is better. We saw him struggle during the game.
Yeah.
Again, I kind of go, look, while you were the trainer, maybe you should have learned a little bit more how to play this game. But no, I think that was great. I think it's so funny because we just had the I Play Rocky trailer came out recently, which amazing. I love. And by the way, I don't know if I'll just say it now because we don't have any rules for a Cinephile's one take, but which is that in general, when you see a biopic, you don't generally want the actor to do an impression of the character. And yet that's really what is going on. He sounds like Rocky. He looks like Rocky.
Yeah.
And the thing about that story is it's the heart that makes Rocky so great.
Yeah.
And at this point, it's, you know, 6 years later or whatever, and he's making this movie, and that heart doesn't seem quite so much there. The arrogance, the movie starness, the look at meanness seems a little bit more there. So it's everything you just described. Changes in the script. John Huston's not showing up on set.
Yeah.
Michael Caine and Stallone are not getting along, and it feels like Stallone is pushing to make a performance. You know what I mean?
That's how
I feel about what he's doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, and he might have been a little bit upset because one of the changes to the script that they made was that the goalie was going to come down and score the tying goal. It was actually supposed to be Stallone who scored the tying goal, but Pele and Bobby Moore were like, goalies don't score goals. That's nonsense. That's crazy. You want this because it's Stallone, but we're not going to do the movie if you have that in there. So they had to change it for him to save the penalty rather than score the goal. They wanted Pele to score the goal. And I think that was a smart move, right?
Absolutely, that's the right move. Because the thing, I wish they had done a little bit more of if you had set up, like when Stallone is playing at the beginning, and part of it too is because he's a movie star, he probably doesn't want to look like he sucks.
Right.
But they should have made him look like he sucks. They should have been not able to dribble the ball, not able to make a pass, not able to do all those things. Why? Because Americans don't know how to use their feet because we didn't grow up playing soccer. You know what Americans are good at? Catching stuff. Yeah. If we had set him up as a baseball player or a football player who was used to using his hands and we go and he's desperately trying to be on the team, but he fucking sucks. And then we have him. Oh, wait, he could be a goalie. And actually, you know, then there's more stuff to play with that they could have done, but they didn't. It's not, again, it's my note of the whole thing. It's not quite there, you know?
Well, there's allusions to it, right? When he becomes the trainer, where he says, well, in my kind of football, I know how to treat injuries and whatever. And even Kobe even says to him when he's in the goalie, when he's catching the ball, he's like, well, you use your feet, I use my hands. But you're right. It's not really kind of explored. What is his actual experience with all of this? How much more can he? And it is alluded to that he's not good at it because, like, when he tackles the guy, like, actually tackles him, like in football, Michael Caine yells at him, goes, I've been telling you for a year that you can't play soccer this way or whatever. So there is allusions to it, but I think you're right. It's not explored deeply enough to where it becomes something that could be a stronger part of the movie so that you have a. You have a full circle moment where he kind of shows you that he can do well when called upon in this moment. So, yeah.
He has a line where he says, I've been telling you this for a year.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a bad line.
When he tackles the guy, when he physically tackles the guy.
So that's a bad line for many reasons. And it's about because it means that Stallone has been playing soccer for a year and still doesn't understand soccer.
I agree with you 100%. It's a dumb line.
You've been playing soccer for a year and you still don't know not to tackle a guy. That doesn't really make sense. You know, I was trying to think of a better example of this, but you know, the moment in The Natural where Roy's on the team and the guy's in the batting cage says, hey, pitch one in here for me. And Roy pitches and it lodges itself at the fence and everyone looks and goes, oh my God, look at that.
Right.
I would have Stallone be terrible with his feet and then have some reason that a ball goes flying and Stallone runs and does like the football catch and catches the one hand thing. Michael Caine looks over and goes, huh. You know, we need that moment where like he sucks at this, but maybe there's something so we're setting him up to be the goal. And you do the thing, you know, of like, maybe he could play goalie, but then we see the real goal, the way they handle the breaking the guy's arm and stuff, which is the goalie. I think you could, I think the scene is good and you could have done much more because we never met that guy.
We
don't, you know, so setting up who that person is and what that means and what that means for him to lose out on this opportunity. It's just missed opportunities in the movie.
I have to say, I hear what you're saying, but I also think that for me, those don't come across. And it maybe is because I have the soccer knowledge. I have the soccer connection. Exactly. So I'm doing like more of the work in my mind than because that's more in, because like, I know I like they show the kid saving balls, being the goalie, this guy. So I know who he is. So when he says like make it a clean break, skipper, in my mind I immediately go, oh, because he knows that like as a goalie, breaking your arm, he might never be able to play again.
Never play again.
Right. So there's
I didn't have that thought.
Right. Yeah, right. I put that thought in there. So in my mind, because I know so much about it. And so I think those are the things they banked on, as I was saying earlier, like the superstar stuff. They also banked on people knowing a lot about the game who were going to watch the movie. But I do think you're right that it's missed opportunities because it's people like you that they want to be in, to get to fall in love with the game. And those are the things you have to do to get people to fall in love with the game is show the particulars and the intricacies of the game, the uniqueness of the game in a way that's accessible to more people. And so I think you're right. There were I still think it was fine for me, but I understand where you're coming from. And I think you are right. For people who don't have it in their bones like I do, these are the things that you have to point out and make sure you stress so that people can get it into their bones eventually, because they'll be excited to learn more about it, which I imagine this film, it's ironic, a film about the Nazis trying to use this game as a propaganda piece. The film itself is in essence a propaganda piece for the game of soccer, right? Yeah. Or football. And I think in that way, if you're a fan of football, I think where the film really comes to life is on the pitch in the last 40 minutes of the movie. And I actually like, it's almost like a mini movie, the entire game.
Yeah, I agree. You
have the characters and you have the drama of like, well, you're getting your asses kicked. This could be bad for you. You're now helping the Nazis. Now you have a chance to escape. They tunnel through, all the water comes out. And who stops you just as you're about in the tunnel, about to leave and go through? It's Pele. And Pele is the one that says to you, we got to go back. We have to. Please, Hutch. We have to. And his sympathy, his emotion is what convinces the team. And Colby even, who had reluctantly be going along with this, Colby is the one who says, you guys want to go back? If you guys want to go back, I want to go back. I think we can win. And then the players join in, who maybe were reluctant, because to them, they're running away from the fight. So they go back onto the pitch. And now we're roused up in this. And I love the reaction of the British guys, like, what the fuck? It's great. Yep. And I think that takes us all the way to that finale. And they get to escape anyway, which I think is a great payoff too.
I 100% agree with you. I think it's a mini movie. I think it works great. All of my quibbles are all about the setup to get to that place.
Yes.
It's once we get to the game, because what's great, and it's so crazy to me that John Huston wasn't on the set for a lot of this, where the movie is really working. Because what's so great is it puts the audience in a perfect, what I would call a fork, which is we want two things that are incompatible, which is that the plan is to escape. That was the whole point. And this is what's interesting too. The other connection to The Great Escape is that what The Great Escape really is, because it's a tragedy and they all, almost all of them die, is it's symbolic. It's you take in that one, you take a tragedy and makes it, and it's somehow that movie makes it feel heroic.
Yeah.
And in this movie, the whole point was for them to escape.
Right.
And yet I want to see the whole game. And so I'm going like, oh, at halftime, the game's going to go. Oh, but I want them to fucking beat these Germans. Like I was very, very involved in the game. And so I'm sitting there in this position of going, well, obviously I want them to escape and that's what's important. Yeah. And that's what the plan is. But I want them to finish the fucking game. So when Pele has that line and it's like, yes, there's this feeling of that's what I want. In fact, it's the Pyrrhic victory. I think that's the right word. That's important. Mm-hmm. It's the symbolic victory that matters. Yeah. It's not actually the escape. And so when they go back out on the field and the French reaction and the British officers are like, why are they here? And you see them fight through that second half, which I think is super exciting.
I do too. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I'm 100% sold in the movie. And it's also, this is an interesting thing too, is just in general, if a movie has an amazing first act and a shitty third act, you will not like that movie. And if the movie has a not so great first act, but an amazing third act, you will like the movie. And I do like this movie. I totally, like there were parts going through it. I was like, what's going on here? But by the time we got to the game, I was 100% completely in.
I don't want to leave the game without saying two things. First, the Pele stuff, him getting punched.
Yeah.
That's meta, because that's why Pele stopped playing for the Brazilian national team. He had become so good that the opposing players were punching him and kicking him and covering it up so the ref wouldn't see it.
Yeah.
And he had taken enough physical abuse. He won that last World Cup, I think in 1970, but that was pretty much the end for him because of the abuse, physical abuse he had taken. And there was jealousy from the other players as well, because Brazil is a very proud country that creates a lot of great players. And to hear one person kind of take the attention, there were a lot of great players on those 70s and 50s Brazilian teams that Pele was a part of. There was resentment there, 50s and 60s rather. And so that's the thing that you have there. So adding that, I think, was a nice little Easter egg for those of us who knew that about Pele and why he left. The other part of this is I think this whole game doesn't work without the commentator. I think he's amazing. This is Anton Differing. No goal. The goal's not allowed. Like, he is so good at bringing the game to life. And anyone who knows football or soccer knows that the commentator is a massive part of you enjoying a game, and they are few and far between. A lot of people complained about the American commentators from the World Cup. The British commentators brought the game to life. Telemundo saw its ratings go up for this World Cup more than the previous World Cup because American English speakers were turning into the Spanish language broadcast of these World Cup games because they were bringing the games to life. Yeah. Andres Cantor being the most famous, but there are other Spanish things. But Anton Diffrin, who was the commentator here, he made a career out of playing Nazi types in war films throughout his entire time as an actor, despite the fact that he left his native Germany in the 1930s to escape prosecution by the Nazis because he was A, Jewish, and B, gay.
Wow.
So I think he is amazing in the movie. And the fact that he is a Jewish gay man who left Germany to escape the Nazis, but he's playing a commentator who is essentially helping the fix by adjusting the cheers and the boos from his broadcast, I think is amazing. But again, I don't think the game works without him commenting the way he does, because he keeps you on the edge of your seat with how he's commenting throughout this stuff.
Well, I mean, honestly, I can't name all of them that we've seen in the Cinephiles, but I remember in Casablanca, it's certainly true. And also, in Judgment in Nuremberg, Werner Klimperer, who went on to be Colonel Klink, also a Jewish German who escaped from the Nazis. Like, right. There's so many Jews who escaped to Hollywood from World War II, and they ended up playing Nazis for lots of their careers, which is weird. But like, and I agree with you. I mean, honestly, I'm obviously, really, without a great announcer, I'm not going to know what the hell's going on. So yeah, I really need that to keep in the game. And as I said, it's my favorite part of the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Agreed for so many reasons as well. As I mentioned earlier, the movie was scored by Bill Conti. I do want to get to this before we wrap up our conversation on this. As I said, the movie is one of around 10 collaborations that Conti did with Stallone. You rarely think about a composer working with an actor to compose a majority of the movies. Usually it's a director like John Williams and Spielberg, you know? So it's interesting that he did 10 of Stallone's movies, including 1989's Lockup and Fist and Paradise Alley. But he wrote the score, which borrows heavily from the first and last movements of Dmitri Shostakovich's Symphony No. 7, the Leningrad Symphony, particularly the march theme of the first movement, which is quoted almost verbatim. And dude, I love the score and I love the music. I can recite it by heart, because it's one of the big things about this movie that I thoroughly love. And Shostakovich's Symphony No. 7 was purportedly meant to represent the resistance to repressive Nazism when it debuted during World War II. Mm. Although Shostakovich did say that he felt that it was more a commentary on all tyranny and oppression, including in his native Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin. At the end of the film, that rousing score we hear that accompanies after Victory, Victora, there, the last part of Shostakovich's Symphony No. 5 is what you hear and is also used to signify the triumphant conclusion of the story. Conti would later employ a similar practice, as I was mentioning earlier, when repurposing much of Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto for the film The Right Stuff. So he worked out what he was going to do for The Right Stuff by doing what he did here with Shostakovich's symphonies for this. And I think this is a massive part of why the movie works as well. It's a rousing theme, just like the Great Escape theme is a rousing theme. Maybe not the same quality, but certainly as memorable, you know?
Well, I wasn't going to bring this up, but now, because you mentioned the Great Escape theme, I have to say this is a discovery I made, and which I'm sure I mentioned when we did Bridge on the River Kwai and Great Escape, is that the theme from Bridge on the River Kwai, Major Bogey's March, they clearly tried to copy in Great Escape and make a very, very similar theme. And I figured this out when driving across the country with my ex, because we realized that both Great Escape and Bridge on the River Kwai have the same first two notes and they last exactly the same length of time. And Karen and I used to sing them together, with her singing one theme and me in the other. And it was just one of those interesting things where you start in the same place and end in the same place, and it all works together. There is a theme in Victory, and I don't remember the time code or where it was, where they 100% clearly were doing exactly the same thing. They were doing, and it was like, because I could hear like, oh, that's Major Bogey's March, except played slightly differently and not quite as good as the Great Escape version of it, you know?
Wow. Well, the film has a 70% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, Steve, so it's not a stinker based on reviews from 10 critics. Audiences polled by CinemaScore gave the film an average grade of an A minus on an A plus to F scale. It was made for $12 million. It made $27.5 million, so not a bomb. Certainly not a box office success, but not a bomb. And apparently the rumor was in 2014 that Doug Liman was in talks to direct a remake with Gavin O'Connor from Warrior and Anthony Tambakis to write the script. And Jean-Michel Serres, as late as 2019, was in talks to direct after a rewrite, but it's gone nowhere since. Maybe the World Cup fervor of how much it reignited people's passions from this most recent World Cup we just finished here in the States and Canada and Mexico will put this back into rotation possibly, and maybe we'll see a remake that answers some of the criticisms you had, Steve, and is a much more thorough film. So your final thoughts on Victor as we wrap this first conversation of our One Takes.
My final thoughts is, A, this has been a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to more One Takes. B, I totally enjoyed it, and I think what's so cool about us doing this now is it gives us a chance to talk about a different thing, which is what we normally are doing on the podcast is talking about a movie's greatness, and this is why this is so great, and this is why this is so brilliant, and this is a movie that you love dearly, I really, really enjoyed. Because you don't watch every movie because every single scene and moment in that movie is artistic perfection.
Yeah.
You watch movies because they're members of your family, because they're things you've grown up with, because they're a particular interest that you love or an actor that you love, or that, and which is the case in this one for me, the last act is worth it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
1,000%. Yeah. My final thoughts are this is just as magical for me as it was when I was a 10-year-old kid or 12-year-old kid rather in Virginia or in DC watching this with my dad in a crowded theater of other probably immigrants who were watching it in DC with and reliving their love of soccer through this film. Whether John Huston directed all of it or not, to me it still comes off as an enjoyable film and one of the best soccer films ever made because of the people involved in terms of the great players. I think this is peak Stallone at the height of his hubris. I think this is Pelé at the height of his charm. I think this is Michael Caine at the height of his attractiveness as a leading man in terms of engaging you with a story. And I think this is a great window into Max von Sydow and all the amazing roles he is going to perform in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s before he passes on. And so there's so much to love about the movie, including Bill Conti's score, that I think is inspirational and rousing. And nowadays, this idea of fighting back against people who would want to, you know, take away your rights or take away your ability to win or are trying to rig the system so that you lose and they want to use you as a prop for their own narratives. I like that this film pushes back and fights back against that, especially with that ending, and they get to escape. And the way it ends, crashing down the walls of the stadium as a protest to being held in by the Nazis. I think there's something really symbolic and powerful in all of that, for sure.
So that's what we think of Victory. We'd love to hear your thoughts. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the Cinephiles One Takes. You can visit us on our Facebook page. Just do a search for the Cinephiles. It's Cine_Files on Twitter, the Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so on whatever podcast app you prefer. Leave your comments if you're on Spotify. Reviews on Apple Podcasts are great. Comments on YouTube are great. So as we said, we're going to be releasing this on our regular podcast feed right away. But in the future, these will show up 1 week early on our Patreon and on Apple Podcasts. And we'll be releasing them on the regular podcast feed the following week. And of course, if people want to reach me, they can do so at SR Morris on Twitter. John, how would people find you?
You can always reach me and my soccer loving ass at The Roca Says. And of course, my YouTube channel, youtube.com/John Roca Says, where we have so many shows and so many amazing guests. Steve occasionally pops in on the channel as well. So please head on over there. And don't forget our YouTube channel, the Cinephiles YouTube channel, that is out there for you all to subscribe to as well. That has all our episodes and all our live shows there for you all to watch if you want to go back through our catalog and enjoy some of those conversations as well.
And that's it for this week. We'll be back with our regular Cinephiles episodes, and there are definitely going to be a lot more Cinephiles One Takes.